coercion?
Well, no, because first of all, they don't, I think you just are, what Paul's saying is, they want you to look at it and ask you to sign it, but they're not going to turn you away if you don't sign it.
But do they give you a chance to read it?
They're supposed to.
Okay.
They're supposed to. Similarly, the physical setting of a hospital mediation may not be in the mediator's control. Meaning, typically when I'm doing a mediation that is attached to an existing lawsuit or involved with something that may become the subject matter of a lawsuit, one can make arrangement, bless you, in a telephonic conference for a date, time, and place for a mediation. One tries to reserve appropriate rooms, including breakout rooms, for the parties to be in so they can be isolated from the people who they, at least at the outset, believe they're adverse to. In a clinical mediation, anything can happen. I mean, again, I think I alluded to this the other day. You might come and find yourself in the hallway of a hospital trying to conduct a mediation, or being in a room that's available to you now that in an hour is no longer going to be available to you, and you're going to go upstairs. And one of the doctors who's in there is going to say, my beeper just went off, and I have an emergency, so what do I do? This is, you know, if I have a bunch of lawyers and their clients in the room, and they're committed to being there for the whole day, you know, absent some kind of life-threatening situation affecting them or their families, they're there. I have them there. If that doctor gets called away, you got to fend for yourself and figure out, when do we reconvene? How do we reconvene? How are we going to communicate about when we're going to reconvene? It's a difficult logistical problem. I think there is one other. Now, here is, again, the other very difficult to get your arms around issue in clinical mediation, confidentiality. So let me try to explain this way. In non-clinical mediation, it is very much presumed that anything that is said in the mediation, called a mediation communication, which would include oral or even a physical written document that's shown in the mediation, would be confidential as to third parties outside the room, that the mediator would not be subpoenaed, or if he or she were, would not come to court and so testify. And in addition to that, if the mediator is asked by one of the parties not to share statement X with the other parties, and remember, we can meet ex parte, as we learned, and we learned the reasons why, because you're not calling balls and strikes. Meet ex parte, but I go into the room with you and you say, as you saw in the video last week, I want X, Y, and Z to happen, but don't tell them I said that. Okay? Absolutely axiomatic. It's not going outside of that door. Now, when you read that Hastings Report paper from the National Working Group, you see all of this stuff about charting in the patient's chart. But first of all, how are you going to put something in the patient's chart if you don't have hospital privileges? Right? I don't know who's putting that in there. It's a little bit vague, right? If I'm the mediator, am I telling, you know, Dr. Smith to put it in there? Because unless and until I get those privileges, I don't think I can do that. So we're not at the point yet, maybe we will be, where the mediator becomes privileged as a function of her training and credentials, but that's projecting way into the future. So to make a long story short, the problem is simply that there may be conditions on the level of confidentiality in a clinical mediation that are a function of state law that applies to what information in a medical record can be accessed, in what context, for example, in a litigation, or without a litigation, or there may be an issue of what the mediation privilege applies to, and whether it trumps. Try to think about this for a minute. Suppose there is a mediation communication that under the laws of the state of Pennsylvania is not privileged, but there is a mediation statute that privileges all mediation communications. Would a court say, and or have they said, or does the statute make clear that the mediation privilege trumps the fact that it is otherwise acceptable, if you see what I'm saying? Now, a lot of this stuff probably becomes not so important because most of the mediation communications, particularly oral communications, are not likely to be the sort of things that would A, either be accessible to third parties or be deemed to be deemed not subject to the mediation privilege, because think about it. There's a difference between something that Katie says in the mediation, like, John, you're a total idiot, or that wall is green, or I hate you, or you stink, or you're a liar, or anything like that, that really doesn't address the health of the patient. I mean, it's really not going to be a part of that patient's medical record, and it also, therefore, is not going to bear on the ability of future physicians to properly care for that same patient, which is obviously one of the reasons that we have medical records. So that we, on one hand, there's a public policy interest on not having processes take place in a hospital that actually are descriptive of the patient's physical and mental well-being, but then become erased so that a subsequent doctor is not aware of something that may be diagnostically important. But yes, go ahead.
I'm just gonna give you a bizarre situation. So what if a wife says to you, I want you to pull the plug because he always abused me and abused my kids. Would you as the mediator need to disclose that, like a physician?
If the wife says.
So if she says that she doesn't want to prolong care anymore and you're trying to get at why, and she finally comes out and says, he abused me and he abuses my kids and I want him to, I mean, that's a rationale.
I want to pull the plug because he abuses my kids?
But he's at end of life, but
right.
She wants everything to stop now.
Right.
So what if she discloses that piece to you, though? Are you obligated like a healthcare provider is?
No.
No.
First of all, what you just said is not something that hasn't yet happened. She's saying something that may or may not be true about the past.
Right.
Right? I think under most formulations of that kind of confidentiality issue, you wouldn't be bound to go and tell them about what is essentially an admission of a prior act. But again, the problem with making definitive statements about these things is that when laws differ, even with a slightly different phraseology, and there can be interpretive questions, and then there can be cases about the interpretation, it's not like you can just say yes or no. The answer is always, it depends. It depends on the statutory law, the case law, the jurisdiction, and so on.
On the other side, though, what about a situation where a midlife question comes up, the patient's severely compromised, and in interviewing both sides, the surgeon tells you, I have to do everything because I screwed up the surgery. I haven't told the family, but I screwed up the surgery.
Repeat the last thing.
I haven't told the family yet.
Yes.
But I did something in the surgery that caused the patient's death, or is causing them to enter the state. Are you obliged to disclose that to the patient's family? I mean, Pennsylvania has a legal disclosure requirement.
Right. I don't know. Anybody have a?
I worked at in nurse management last summer at the Medical College of Wisconsin, and they have an institutional policy. Anytime you have an adverse event, they have to disclose it to the family.
We have a state law in Pennsylvania that says you have to, but that doesn't mean it always happens.
Right, well, I mean, I guess with them, then they have to contact nurse management.
But the state law in Pennsylvania that you're talking about applies to whom?
It applies to the physician.
The doctor.
The physician who made the mistake?
Yes.
Oh, that, but that's totally different. I thought you were saying, does the third party who hears?
No, I'm sorry, no.
Oh.
Oh, as the mediator, I hear, do I have an obligation to disclose that to the family?
I thought that's what, was that what you were asking?
Yes.
Yeah, I don't know that the answer to that is the same in every jurisdiction. My sense of it is that the problem with a lot of these statements that we're talking about, and the reason they have to be looked at with a fine-tooth comb, is because, remember, lots of people say lots of things that can be misinterpreted, and that whether they should be given the weight of what you're saying is an admission, you know, I'm not so sure whether it doesn't run into kind of evidentiary problems, but I don't know the answer to it, and so I don't want to try to answer something and give you a bum steer. If it's a question, that kind of question and these kinds of issues, if anyone becomes very interested in this, can be like a choice of paper topic for a final paper, as long as you tie it back to the issues in clinical mediation and don't go off on a tangent that takes you away from that. Okay? Because these kinds of questions they're complicated and usually involve differing points of view and different sets of laws. And finally, consensus in a clinical mediation may not result in a written settlement agreement. Again, remember, we looked at the video and the mediator made a clear point of once they had reached apparent agreement, getting them to sign or initial a bullet point agreement. We talked about why that was the case and stuff. The reality is, in most of these hospital mediations, there's not going to be anything like that. The agreement is going to be as good as the word that the parties give and as long and durable as they want it to be. Meaning that very frequently, even though they reached a consensual resolution of the dispute, 3 weeks later, they don't think that's a good thing anymore, and they come and say, no, you're back at the mediation table, or the, yeah. Alternatively, the party who gets to make the call makes the call. So,
how often does that happen, and like how often are you just going round and round? And
yeah, well, how often does it happen?
Yeah.
It happens, in my experience, less from changes of mind than from misunderstandings on the part of people, and also what they deem to be a breach of the agreement by the other side. So they'll never say, oh, I shouldn't say never, they usually won't say, I changed my mind. Yes, I agreed to X, but I changed my mind. They'll say, I agreed to X when she said X, Y, and Z, but now that she's
right.
doing, you know, Z, F, and
right.
N, why should I
right.
abide by this,
right.
is typically the way it plays out. But it would be awfully difficult and probably just not feasible to get people to sign on to a written agreement in this context. And also, I think the more formalities that you throw out there, even if you could get them to be adhered to, they would start to intimidate people again. And we'd be involved in a circular process, because one of the things we're trying to offer people is the avoidance of all of that red tape, that, you know, following by the book, doing stuff that I can't quite understand, writing things down, you know, doing what they say is the right thing to do. As soon as you start getting into that, you're sort of moving back into going by the book, doing it by extrinsic norms, rather than this is what the people said, this is what they will abide by for as long as they're willing to abide by it. I think that's really the terrain in clinical mediation. Any questions about any of that stuff? I know it's a lot, and I don't want you to be concerned by the fact that a lot of this stuff is gray area and doesn't have neat black lines around it and can be put in a box. It's the very nature of this stuff, and if you are becoming enmeshed in it, you're not going to master it by memorizing things as though they're black letter rules, because that ain't the way this functions. It's not about black letter rules, it's about a way of thinking, a way of behaving, a way of dealing with these phenomena in a manner that can encourage people to do things they wouldn't otherwise be able to do, left to their own devices. I just have to give you out the games for next week.
I just had a quick question. When you were talking about charting and the ethicist then tell the doctor, right now, clinical ethicists, a designated clinical ethicist at a hospital, do they not have charting privileges, or can they not put
If they're privileged, and they may be.
If they're like, if that is their role.
Right,
okay.
Exactly. Okay. But it's my understanding that there is not any kind of uniform national, or even, I don't think, state standard for that, meaning it would be on a hospital-by-hospital basis.
Okay.
Okay. Paula, I'm going to call out your name, so if you could come to me and just prepare this for mediation class next week. Shauna? Would you just hand them over? Amy? Katrina? Now, again, there are some doubled up roles, Lisa, because of the number of parties in the game. Wei, if you find Victoria. David?
Thanks.
You're welcome. And then, can you pass that to him?
Thank you.
Richard, pass down to Richard. Victoria?
Thank you.
You're welcome. Rebecca, Nicole.
What happened to all the great
Christina, Steve,
Dr.
Dan,
you
can have Tua,
maybe. You're the
Nidus. Does anybody know tonight?
The star.
That's
no
great.
Pressure.
Elizabeth. Chelsea. Where did Chelsea go?
She might have skedaddled.
She was here a minute.
Oh, yeah, she left early.
Oh, did you? Does anybody see Chelsea?
I will see her on Monday or Tuesday.
That's good enough. That's great. Katie.
Hope I remember. Please try to help me. Remember.
Would you pass that to Katie?
Sorry.
Okay.
Monday?
Corbett?
Whenever
you see me.
We're not the same last time.
Bridge?
Vaccines?
No. Jenny.
Patsy.
Jenny. A switch.
All right, guys. Have a good week.